Welcome to this week's America podcast. I'm Luke Hansen, an associate editor of America. The November 18th issue of America marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Today, I am interviewing Jim Douglas, author of this week's cover story, A President for Peace. Jim is the author of JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters, and several books on nonviolence. He's also a co-founder of Mary's House Catholic Worker in Birmingham, Alabama. Jim, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks, Luke.
So first I want to ask about November 22nd, 1963. Where were you at the time and what kind of immediate impact did the assassination have on you?
I was in Rome, Italy. I was lobbying at the Second Vatican Council for a statement condemning total war and supporting conscientious objection. I remember a divine word seminarian walking up a hill. He had to walk up a hill to get to our apartment and knocking on the door and telling us the terrible news. My wife and I just walked around Rome rather stunned by it all, and we didn't have television to follow the events as people in this country did. So my main response to it was writing to Dorothy Day, who had been with us staying in that apartment the previous spring. She came in a pilgrimage, Women for Peace, in response to Pope John's great encyclical, Peace on Earth. So I asked Dorothy's thoughts in response to JFK's assassination. She wrote back, and in a very thoughtful way, asking the wisdom to reflect with St. Paul on, for those who love God, all things work together unto good. And then she suggested I learn something about the man by reading a portrait of him in the New Yorker magazine. I didn't realize she had actually met him many years ago. She didn't mention that. And thirdly, she said, I'm going to pray to him. And she emphasized the word, she underlined it. It took me a long time to catch up to what she was suggesting, that although she was an anarchist and wasn't a strong supporter of White House politics, to put it mildly, she saw something in Kennedy that urged reflection and consideration, although she, of course, didn't know any details on his assassination. So she was a kind of inspiration when I look back at it, although I didn't take it so at the time.
In the America article, which is titled A President for Peace, you make a connection between Kennedy's assassination and the type of president he was and what he pursued as president. Now, the image that you present of Kennedy really conflicts with sort of the popular notion of Kennedy as a Cold War hawk, which is really firmly established in so many people's minds. So what did you learn about the Kennedy presidency during your research for your book?
That part of the research was drawing heavily on documentation in State Department volumes. There are a couple of dozen of them of the entire Kennedy presidency, and of course on a lot of different personal sources and interviews. What I learned was that John Kennedy was indeed, as he came into the presidency, a cold warrior, and some of his policies were strongly in that direction. And as I thought at the time, while I was watching him from Rome to some extent while I was over there, I was very concerned about his policies. And I wrote an article for the Catholic Worker in those years urging him, or saying that he should have, in resolving the missile crisis, have traded missile bases with Nikita Khrushchev rather than simply demanding that he pull his missiles out of the base that was alongside our country. I didn't realize at all that that's exactly what he had done secretly in an agreement with Khrushchev. So I learned those kinds of things 30 years later, and it's basically an untold story to a very large extent, because if you understand how he was turning toward peace, then you understand the whole motivation for his assassination. And that was beginning to happen even before the Cuban Missile Crisis in the Bay of Pigs, he drew a line in the sand and said he would not send in combat troops. And when the CIA put him in a position where, through lying to him and saying that the information was that there would be an uprising in Cuba over against Fidel Castro and the revolutionary government, which was not true, and then telling him that there was terrain where the exile brigade could go guerrilla, which was not true. Afterwards, he was just totally disenchanted by the CIA and said, I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. And then he fired the director of the CIA, most powerful man in the Cold War, Alan Dulles, and his deputies. So from that point on, he was step by step moving toward a different kind of position. In Laos, he was working with people who were seen very negatively by the CIA, communists, independents, and he was then in the missile crisis was the key moment, because he did have a blockade against Cuba, but the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the CIA, and almost all of his advisors wanted him to bomb and invade Cuba. This was the big opportunity, and he refused. And as things became tenser and tenser, he was losing control. General Curtis LeMay was sending his Air Force planes farther and farther beyond the normal range they had, so that the Soviets thought that any of them could possibly be attacking. He test-fired a missile into the Pacific, which they could have thought was a missile fired at them. In other words, he was baiting them, and they didn't accept the bait, so fortunately. But Kennedy was feeling, I'm losing control. They want to do this, as he said afterwards. And so he sent Robert Kennedy, his brother, the Attorney General, to Anatoly Dobrynin and said that they needed to act quickly to get out of this mess, or there was going to be a nuclear war. And Khrushchev heard that appeal and turned to his foreign minister, we have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him. And at that point, the whole Cold War turned upside down, and both Kennedy and Khrushchev were closer to their to each other, to the enemy, than either was to his own generals. So from that point on, Kennedy was moving. In the American University address, he called for an end to the Cold War. He then signed a nuclear test ban treaty with Khrushchev in 6 weeks, got it through the Senate through an amazing process of appealing to the American people and organizing, and began a back-channel dialogue with Fidel Castro to normalize relations with Cuba, and then signed National Security Memorandum 263 to end the Vietnam War, withdraw 1,000 troops by the end of 63, and the bulk of U.S. personnel out by 65. And when you understand those things, and I document the ways in which it was creating greater and greater friction and alarm among a huge number of people who had very powerful positions, both within his government and in the military-industrial complex, that's the background to his assassination.
In the America article, you refer to the assassination then as a transparent act of state. And as you said, your book really lays out in a very thorough way and makes the case that implicates the CIA, the FBI, the Dallas police in the assassination of Kennedy. But, you know, some of the readers have already responded to your article and said, you know, it's been 50 years, and if there was a conspiracy, we would know it by now, and it would be publicly known, it would be well known, the information would be out there, but the information isn't there, and so it's basically silly to continue talking about a conspiracy this much later. How do you respond to that?
The information is out there. That's what startled me. I'm a Catholic worker. I'm not a professional historian. I worked hard for 12 years in doing the research, but Woodward and Bernstein could have done it a lot faster than that. But you have to go to it. You have to seek it out. In 1992, the JFK Records Act was passed as a result of the Oliver Stone film and a lot of citizens asking Congress to make public assassination-related materials. So there's a huge building in College Park, Maryland, that is totally devoted to hundreds of thousands of JFK administration and assassination-related documents. There's a huge volume of foreign relations with the United States that documents all kinds of things. So I have 100 pages of endnotes that tell the background to everything I've written in the actual text. The mainstream press does not want to go there. So that's why the book is called JFK and the Unspeakable. This is the unspeakable. The assassination of the President of the United States because he was becoming a peacemaker by his own government intelligence agencies and military is the unspeakable that Merton was talking about in Raids on the Unspeakable. And the media don't want to go there. Universities don't want to go there. Investigators don't want to go there. Because if we do, we get into a deeper and deeper reflection upon the nature of our society, the nature of our government, and the nature of security, what's security all about. And we have a very extraordinary story that we encounter. It's a gospel story because Kennedy is making a turn. He was a cold warrior. He did turn toward peace, and he did so consciously recognizing he was risking his life. That is an extraordinary story. And I was just astonished that it hadn't been told in depth before.
Now, there was one piece about the conspiracy I wanted to ask you about because it really struck me as new and I hadn't read it anywhere else. And that was the connection you established between Lee Harvey Oswald and the CIA. Have other Kennedy assassination historians picked up on that? Has that been written about elsewhere? Can you talk a little bit about that?
There are people who have written about that before I ever did, and I was drawing on some great researchers. Philip Melanson wrote a very good book about the CIA and Lee Harvey Oswald. John Newman wrote a book of that nature. So there have been very important pieces of literature on it. But again, you won't find it out by reading the New York Times. You won't find it out by reading any of the mainstream media. You have to go look for it. Oswald was working with the CIA from the time he was a Marine at Atsugi Air Force Base in Japan. He was a top secret clearance radar operator for the U-2 spy plane, the CIA's spy plane. So Oswald was connected from the CIA with the CIA from the 50s when he was a Marine, and when he left the Marine Corps rather abruptly and almost instantly became a defector to the Soviet Union, that was his continuing relationship with the CIA. He was a false defector. Naval intelligence was working with him, and the story is so strange. He goes to the both the U.S. embassy and the in Moscow, and he goes over to the Soviets, and he actually says to the U.S. embassy that he's going to renounce his citizenship or wants to renounce his citizenship, and that he is going to pass on to the Soviets the information he got as a Marine in the military. Well, you know, that's U-2 information, the most top secret device the United States had for spying on the Soviet Union. And after he's in the Soviet Union for a couple of years and comes back to the U.S., he does so with welcome arms, with State Department support. What is going on here? I mean, he should have been, on the face of it, prosecuted as a traitor. Well, what's going on is he's an intelligence operator, and he then settles in Dallas, Texas, with his Russian wife, Marina, and their children, and then he is under the guidance of a CIA-connected man named George de Morenshield. The story from right down the line is Oswald is always connected with CIA people right up to the day of his involvement as a patsy. I mean, Oswald, of course, didn't realize that he was going to become the scapegoat in the assassination. And he did not shoot John F. Kennedy. He was having lunch in the second floor when that happened.
You refer to the assassination as the unspeakable, and you've described the unwillingness of the American media to really grapple with what happened 50 years ago. So, but I'm wondering how members of the Kennedy family have responded to your research and some of the conclusions you draw from your research. Have any members of the family responded to your work?
Well, Robert Kennedy has made public, so I can say that he has been very supportive, and he has given a very strong endorsement of the book just this fall. And he tried to do it in Dallas in January in an interview with Charlie Rose, but the interview was not made public, so the endorsement didn't get very far. But he phoned me and expressed his support, and a friend had given him the book, and he finished reading it in Dallas, which was a providential event. And as he says in his endorsement, which is in the magazine, this issue, and then he went to Dealey Plaza.
We had a conversation in 2008 when Senator Barack Obama was running for president. And at the time, JFK's daughter, Caroline, had gone to American University, the place of the significant talk that Kennedy gave that you describe in the America article.
Yes.
She went there to endorse him. And at the time, you thought that was very significant. And it might have said something about, who Barack Obama was and the type of president that he could be. Now, 5 years later, how do you look at the Obama presidency?
Well, in relation to the choice that her uncle Ted and Caroline Kennedy made to have that endorsement take place at American University, which they were obviously identifying as the hope they had, the fulfillment of Kennedy's vision through Barack Obama's presidency, I must say it's been a disappointment, a very strong disappointment. And he faced, of course, the same challenge that John F. Kennedy did, in his case, not Vietnam, but Afghanistan. And whereas JFK turned in a direction against the Vietnam War, Barack Obama faced by exactly the same kind of process. Kennedy had asked his generals to provide him with a withdrawal plan. And I documented in the book how in meeting after meeting, they shilly-shallied or just didn't do it. They would not provide the withdrawal plan. And finally, he just wrote out his national security memorandum for the withdrawal himself. They wouldn't even obey Secretary McNamara in doing that. Obama faced exactly the same thing. It's documented in early books about his presidency. But unfortunately, although he was very angry about it, he surrendered to his military chiefs, and he's been surrendering ever since. So that has resulted in some terrible consequences to many people. But he recognizes the risk if he goes the other way, and as did Kennedy, and he has chosen not to accept that risk.
With the 50th anniversary upon us now, have you found that your book on JFK's assassination has started a larger conversation in any way? What kind of follow-up has happened to the book? What kind of things have come from it?
It has gotten around a lot. It was picked up by Simon & Schuster, but the way it's gotten around has been word of mouth. The mainstream media treat it as the title, The Unspeakable. It is not reviewed, and it is only individual people who pick it up. And Oliver Stone gave it a big endorsement on the Bill Maher show when he was interviewed one day. And I guess I can mention that I'm scheduled to have an interview with Alec Baldwin soon. So there are a few people who will go there, but on the whole, no. It's a process where people get inspired to do things, passing it on to other people, or plays. There have been two plays written that are being read this fall, and one 8 times this month, another at least a couple of times that I'm aware of. And the first one in Dallas, including a reading by Martin Sheen, that's a play called Noah's Ark, based on the image that Nikita Khrushchev shared with JFK in his first secret letter to the president. And there's a graphic adaptation of the book being made. So the book, and it's being translated into a number of languages. The French translation just came out. But in terms of what we need to know in this country, it's got a long, long way to go. And I thank America for this week allowing me to write about the reason behind JFK's assassination, which is a hopeful reason. If he had not been willing to stand down his generals, if he had not been willing to resist them at the most critical moment in the nuclear age, in perhaps in history, because of the weapons and the conflict, we wouldn't be having this conversation, Luke Hansen, right now, nor would there be anybody to listen to it. It would be a nuclear wasteland around this part of the world, most of the world.
We've been talking about the JFK assassination, but I know you've done a lot of research on all of the major assassinations of the 1960s. So could you talk a little bit about what you've learned as a whole from your research and whether there are connections between these?
Well, I didn't start with JFK in relation to the inspiration. That came from Martin Luther King. And I did attend the trial in 1999, the wrongful death lawsuit held in Memphis, initiated by the King family for Dr. King's assassination. I heard 70 witnesses over a three-week period testify to a very sophisticated conspiracy that involved the FBI, CIA, Memphis Police Department. It was, again, a government-run conspiracy, and Dr. King was assassinated because of his resistance to the Vietnam War, 1 year to the day after his Riverside Church address, which was such a profound condemnation of the Vietnam War, and then the other three, well, of course, we've already talked about JFK. RFK was following in JFK's steps. His assassination was for the same reasons, with one added, not only because of what JFK was doing in against the Vietnam War and for nuclear disarmament and all the steps he was taking for justice and peace, but Robert Kennedy also planned, as soon as he was elected president, to reopen the investigation into his brother's death. He was not going to be allowed to do that. And then the third one is Malcolm X, which in its own way is complementary to, especially to Martin Luther King's assassination. The two of them were coming together at the final stage of Malcolm's life, and Malcolm X was a profound resistor to the Vietnam War, and Malcolm X was a radical critic of racism in a way that drew especially on African leaders for his going to the United Nations. Malcolm X had been campaigning throughout Africa, an untold story through the last months of his life, and he had gotten strong support from African nationalist leaders to put the U.S. in effect on trial in the United Nations for racism in this country, parallel to South Africa's racism. So there, each of those stories are need to be explored, and that's what I'm working on now, and not only on how they were killed, but the why, and the why covers a purposeful destruction of hope and of visionary change in this country and in the world. But if we don't understand what happened then, we can't understand the obstacles to change now.
So you've described these assassinations as part of a gospel story and a hopeful story. So finally, I just want to ask you about, you know, what are the implications of these events for Americans today? What is the challenge? What is the invitation?
Well, the invitation is to see connections that we don't want to make. They are unspeakable kinds of connections. I see all four as gospel stories because All four of these human beings turned in a way that corresponds to the prophet's visions, Jesus' vision, Gandhi's vision, in ways that led to their martyrdom. These are stories of martyrs, witnesses to the truth, accepting the consequences in ways that can transform us, but we have to go to the truth of their stories and not accept the propaganda that has covered over what they were trying to establish in this country and in the world, and what deep forces were committed to stopping. And those forces are even more powerful today than they were then, and that is precisely because we haven't dealt with the assassinations of those men and the ways in which they are tied in directly with national security. National security means, in these instances, terrorism on our own soil. And I know the stories of the witnesses, I know the stories of the martyrs, and they are victims of terrorist policies. But they turned it around through their courage and through their initiative and through their willingness to take those consequences. Those are stories of inspiration to us all as soon as we learn them and learn the real truth.
This is Luke Hansen. I've been talking with Jim Douglas, author of JFK and the Unspeakable, and the author of this week's cover story in America, A President for Peace. Jim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Luke.